Te jure de nuire, le jour ou la nuit. T'es mon cœur, mon témarangai.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. It's 17 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Thursday, the 4th of April. So nice to have you with us on the program. I hope you are being safe and cautious. It's one of those storms where, depending on where you are, you could be getting rain, you could be getting nothing, you could be getting an inch or a dusting, you could get a little mixed precipitation, or like 2 feet of snow. So depending on where you are, the news team and the weather team are on it, and they'll have updates throughout the day. And of course, the big forecast coming up during Midday Magazine as well during the hourly newscast, and we'll keep you up to date on what's happening. But it isn't great. So to take it slow and take it easy if you have to be out this morning. We are, as I mentioned to Ray, we have all of our group on the phone today, joining us remotely. So we're lucky because we're keeping them safe. And also, I know sometimes there are technical issues that make you all, the listener, complain. And I just want you to know that's not going to happen today. Rob Chacon, our engineer, is laughing. But yes, we'll try. Everything will be fine. Let me introduce the group to you, and then we'll get started. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Delighted to be here on this lovely winter spring day.
This lovely winter April day, yes. Right. It's wonderful to have you here. We're lucky. I had twice in a week. And yesterday, today, I felt like I did win the lottery. So thank you for being
here. In advance, thank you for having me.
It's always good to have you here. An advance lead for the White House and former Chief of Staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former Assistant County Executive for Pat Ryan, Anna Markowitz, joins us. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. My kids are home from school today, so I apologize in advance if any unsightly noises come from my line.
Well, I don't. How old are the kids?
9 and almost 12.
Oh, all right.
So hopefully they'll behave themselves.
Oh, I'm sure they will. Yeah. Now, a lot of kids already have the week off because of spring break, but in your district, they're there, and those schools are closed, so... good for them. They got a snow day. We also want to thank CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, for being here this morning. Hi, Heather.
Hi, good morning. It's a lovely day here in Brunswick.
How are the horses?
They're covered in snow and mud simultaneously. This is the worst year of mud ever, but they're in the barn right now, so they're very happy.
Yeah, I bet they are. Well, oddly, I was going to say, well, send them my regards. But I guess I can still say that. Send them my regards. I hope they're all well.
Sure, I'll do that.
Thank you.
They know you well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. All right, let's get started, and we'll talk about what's happening in the world. We do welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we begin this morning. Well, let me begin with just a good old-fashioned political story, and that is the fact that there are these polls. Now, we've been seeing polls for the last several months, almost up to a year, where the approval rating for President Joe Biden has been not great and slipping often. What the new set of polling from the Wall Street Journal, which has come out, shows that former President Donald Trump leads President Biden in 6 of the 7 swing states. So for those people on our panel who have uttered the words, this election is going to be held in the following states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, in alphabetical order, then that would indicate that this is not great news at all for the Biden administration and their reelection hopes. Real quick, looking at the states, Wisconsin is the only state that is tied. Meanwhile, Trump is up 5 in Arizona, 1 in Georgia, which isn't a lot, obviously, 3% in Michigan, 6% in North Carolina, 4% in Nevada, and 3% in Pennsylvania. Overall, the poll shows substantial unhappiness with President Biden among voters who will have the most influence in the outcome of the election, as expanded one-party dominance in states has left just a few as politically competitive. The one outlier we mentioned is Wisconsin, where Biden leads by 3 points on the multiple candidate ballot and where the two candidates are tied in a head-to-head matchup. Two more states are also viewed in play, as we mentioned, Nevada and North Carolina, which Biden won Nevada and North Carolina, the state that backed Trump by the slimmest margin in 2020. Both campaigns will spend hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising and turnout efforts in these states, which account for 93 electoral votes out of the 270 needed to win. Do that math. The Wall Street Journal is focused on these swing states in their reporting and looking at how of what is happening on the ground and looking at issues like the economy, immigration, abortion, and mental and physical fitness needed to be president, with Biden only leading on the issue of abortion. Anna Markowitz, what do you make of this?
Oh, well, obviously this is a wake-up call, and, you know, if the fire wasn't already turned up all the way on high, it should be now. But at the same time, I don't really pay that much attention to polls, especially at this point in the race. I mean, if you look at 2016, all of the polls were saying that Hillary was going to win, and that one didn't turn out so well. And if you look at 2020, they were the least effective polls that had ever been conducted in the last 40 years. So polls, it seems, are getting less accurate. After 2016, they realized that they weren't weighting education completion enough and that that was skewing the polls. After 2020, they were like, we don't really know. It could just be that less people are answering polls. And I don't know, that doesn't build my confidence in these polls if we don't know why they're not being as accurate as they were historically. And so now they're saying that it could be a 7% margin in a lot of these polls. And, you know, none of those numbers that you said were greater than 7%. So in my mind, they really still could go either way. So I hope that they are wrong. I hope that the Democrats still have a solid chance of winning most of those states. So I'm just going to take this as we need to put our full throttle effort in here, but not get too distraught over it.
Heather Mulligan.
So first, I think to me, it really reinforces the notion that we should apportion the Electoral College votes in each state rather than have them. I mean, two states do that, but most states are winner take all, New York included, but also Florida and, you know, the states in California that have a lot of Electoral College votes, that if they were not winner take all, it would force basically the candidates to campaign in every state, which in my opinion would have a great moderating influence. And actually, you know, it's funny that when you look at it, it's a handful of states that determine the outcome of the election, but it's even worse than that because in these states, there are generally speaking one county in each state that is a sort of the predictor of which way the state is going to go. And the candidates know this, and if you win these counties, you will win that state. So you have this intense sort of focus on satisfying the voters in these handful of counties in this huge country of ours in order to win the presidency. And I do think it's sort of absurd. I think the poll really just highlights that, you know, people are not happy with the choices that they have. Ordinarily, you know, if you were running a campaign and you're this far from the election, you're like, well, okay, let's see what opposition research we can do on the other candidate. How can we educate the voters about the flaws of the other candidate and drive their numbers down? Well, I mean, if there's more on Trump, I don't think it's going to have any influence on the outcome. I mean, at this point, the guy's been indicted how many times? And I don't think that there's any news that we could hear about Trump that are going to change his numbers. So it does, you know, kind of pose a fundamental question. Given the state of the economy, which is actually pretty good, voters are still dissatisfied with Biden. I just think, you know, as a candidate, we're seeing that this is going to be an extraordinarily difficult election for him to win. So, but it's a little unnerving.
Teresa Bourgeois, we have about 2 minutes, but we certainly have time on the other side of the break.
So I agree with Anna. Polls have consistently not proven to be correct in the last few years. We have to be mindful of that. I think this poll also has a plus or minus of 6%, which means essentially they're tied. But I think ultimately, President Biden has a very strong record on infrastructure. He has a strong record on, we were talking about this yesterday, healthcare, women's rights, and democracy. And I think that they have the ability to get that message out, and they will. And I think that Trump's constituency is finite and could be shrunk if the Democrats run a good campaign. And it's important not just for the presidential campaign, but key House and Senate races as well. But I do think that even if Biden was ahead in this poll, I would say the same thing. These polls have proven to not be very effective. It's a lucrative business. It's easy to talk about the numbers, but I think we need to get talking about the issues.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on this subject, and we'll welcome your letters as well. Those are already coming in. We have Teresa Bourgeois, Anna Markowitz, and Heather Mulligan with us on this Thursday morning. And we welcome your comments, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I give this warning, just to everyone, not a warning, but a helpful hint every once in a while to just keep your emails as short and to the point as possible, and that way we can get to as many letters as we possibly can. We will continue our conversation with this great group after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. Teresa Bourgeois, Anna Markowitz, and Heather Mulligan on the program this morning, talking about polling, talking about the Wall Street Journal poll, which was taken March 17th to the 24th, and showing out of the 7 battleground states, Donald Trump leading in 7 of those. But Teresa is correct with the margin of error, much, much closer races, a 6-point margin of error stated within the poll, and only the state of Wisconsin, where it appears to be a dead heat. One of the points that the Wall Street Journal makes is that looking back in 2020, Biden pulled off a remarkable feat, winning 3 states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin in the industrial North, which had been slipping from Democrats' grasp and had backed Trump in 2016. He won by even narrower margins in Georgia and Arizona, 2 fast diversifying states in the South and Southwest, where Democrats have long unfulfilled hopes of victory. 2 more states are also viewed in play. Nevada, as I mentioned, which Biden won, but where Democratic margins have narrowed, in North Carolina, the state that backed Trump by the slimmest margin in 2020. Anna Markowitz, I was hearing from the following the announcement regarding the six-week abortion ban in the state of Florida that the campaign manager for the Biden team said that they felt Florida was in play. Could that actually be?
I hope so. You know, I trust that they have done their research down there if they're making that kind of declaration. And, you know, there definitely are demographic changes happening in the state. So that would be delightful. But I'm not totally sure.
When you look at the polls, Teresa, and even, you know, it's a snapshot. But look, I guess what's mind-boggling to me is that you have a candidate who is as tinged with issues as someone can be, like Donald Trump, and yet does not seem to be impacted by really any of it.
Well, we shall see on election day, I remain astounded by the fact that he has as much apparent support, that Trump has as much apparent support as he does. But also, I think that the Biden administration and the Democratic Party, they have been very effective at raising money, which is a show of that's a form of a poll in itself. If people want to support you, now of course Hillary Clinton had a lot of money and she ended up, you know, we know what happened there. But they seem to be putting together a very extensive and targeted ground game, and particularly in key states, I think that will make a big difference. And I think that the president's State of the Union message was very strong. And then you've seen in the last several weeks since then, he has been out all around the country in these key states talking about issues that matter in people's lives. And one of the things that that poll did show in a second poll yesterday was that people are feeling better about their own personal family economy. They still think the general economy is not good, but they're feeling better about their own economy. And you never know what's going to happen, but I think people are going to remember that how they felt after Donald Trump was elected the last time and all the people that went out into the streets. I think that if Trump keeps talking about bringing back his tax cut, average working Americans are going to remember that the benefits of the tax cut went to the highest earners in the country, and it really hurt our economy in terms of deficits and so on and so forth. I mean, I think that the Democrats have the resources and the ability to remind people what the choices are in issues that matter in their lives, and hopefully they'll do it.
Heather, as the CEO of the Business Council, do you get a sense of the mood in the room among your membership?
I do. I also want to answer a different question.
Sure.
If I could.
You can do both.
Because you mentioned Florida. So I'll start with that. So Florida in 2016, Democrats actually outnumbered, registered Democrats outnumbered Republicans by a couple hundred thousand. And in 2024, Republican registration has grown by almost, since then, by almost a million. And the Republican registration has grown by almost a million, and Democratic Party has actually lost numbers. So there's a split now in Florida of almost a million more registered Republicans than Democrats. And I think that poses a real problem. And that's why it's not listed as a swing state anymore, because there really is Republican Party dominance in the state at this point in terms of registered voters. That being said, you know, the fact that abortion might be on the ballot, it may create a drive for more people to vote Democratic. But Florida voters have a long history of splitting the ticket, of voting for, you know, a Republican governor and then Democratic local representatives. So I don't think Biden has any real shot in that state, despite the fact that you've got this sort of toxic issue for Republicans on the ballot. And so the business, onto the business council question, and I'll be quick so others can talk because I know I can be long-winded, but I do a poll. The business council does a poll with Siena of CEOs, upstate CEOs, every year. We've done it for, 10 plus years. CEOs are very, very unhappy with both the federal government and the state government. And who's in last place, goes back and forth. But the upstate CEOs actually view the state government like in the 20s in terms of favorability. And then the federal government maybe in the 30s. It's not good either.
Right.
Not hugely surprising, but with the economy in such good shape nationally, I would expect the view of the federal government to be better than it is. At the state level, obviously, we are lagging, still continue to lag behind the rest of the country because of policies that really create a drag on the economy. I'll be quiet now.
You don't have to be quiet.
Can I ask her a question?
Yes, of course.
For the business folks, is that because business folks, I believe, they like certainty. And is part of the problem that there's so much uncertainty because there's so much deadlock in D.C.? Is that part of what has them concerned, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think inaction, the inability of Congress to reach agreement on anything, like immigration, they were so close. I think the business community would like to see some kind of improvement in immigration policy, and I'm being very generous. The uncertainty of what is – if you can't pass a simple, a tax bill, it does cause, a decline in approval ratings amongst the business community. In the New York case, it's not actually the inability to get things moving. It's the policy direction that the state is going in without regard to the economic condition of the state and what it will take to get to where the state wants to get to.
Well, in the case of the immigration bill, I think it's important to remind everyone that, of course, it was Donald Trump who stepped in and killed the immigration bill when the White House and the Senate and House Democrats had negotiated with the very conservative Republicans on what would have been a Hallmark deal, not a comprehensive one, but would have begun to address some of the issues. And it's President Biden who's worked out the bipartisan agreements that have been able to be worked out, and the Democrats working with the House to get the legislation, the basic funding bills passed. The other thing about Florida, can I ask you another question, is the independents. Is there a growing number of people registering as independents in Florida?
So I can tell you that if you are talking about minor parties, which would be not no party affiliation, that has grown. In 2017, there were only 65,000 minor party affiliation, and now there's over 300,000. The no party affiliation is, which is what people usually mean when they say independence. And I only make the differentiation because there is actually an independence party in New York, which is not people who are not affiliated. But the no party affiliation in Florida has actually gone down a little bit. It had reached sort of a high water mark in 2022 of about 4 million. It's lost another 500,000. So they're down to about 3.5 million, which is about a million less than Florida Democratic Party registrants. And the Republican Party is well over 5 million.
We have a lot of letters. Let me get to those after a break. And we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 13 minutes before the hour of 10 o'clock, we do have a bunch of letters talking about polling, and this poll from the Wall Street Journal regarding swing states in the general election coming up in November of this year. Russ writes, the Democratic Party has benefited from the GOP primary process and the forwarding of fringe candidates, such as in the gubernatorial race in North Carolina. But the demographics still favor the dominance of red states in the electoral contest. Both the presidency and the Senate will tend toward the Republican side, and now even more so if the Nebraska GOP succeeds in acting winner takes all. Anything you'd like to say about that, Teresa?
No, why don't we go on to the the letters?
All right. I've been
spurned. No. I mean, I talk too much, so I'm trying to listen more and talk. I have 10 minutes I want to say on that.
All right. Okay. Just remember, by definition, this is a talk show.
I know, but I want to listen to what the listeners have to say.
Bill says this issue to discuss is this. There will be no real presidential election in 2024. Trump and his armed supporters will not leave the Capitol this time. Trump will not admit defeat, no matter what any results say. He will not call his supporters off this time. That is obviously a fear amongst many, especially those on the left. And it seems fantastical, and yet I don't know how to articulate an argument against it, Anna.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that is a solid concern. I, for one, was very nervous about President Biden's inauguration when he was sworn in, because I was worried that there might be attacks after the January 6th riot. So I sure hope he's wrong, but I don't have too much faith.
Eddie writes, if I'm any indication, I'm over it with so many polls and surveys and texts and phone calls and almost everything from politics to how was your experience on our website. I don't believe numbers on the polls. I think part of it is just plain burnout. That from Eddie. Then we go to Amy. Don't get me wrong. I like her, but many voters do not. I would like her to step down. This is about Kamala Harris. I didn't know what she was talking about at first, but then I looked at the subject line, and it's the Kamala Harris problem is the subject line of the letter. I would like her to step down so there's no issue about Biden's age and who the president would be if he dies. I don't know.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, is she really the problem? I don't know.
No. I don't think she's the problem. I'm extremely biased. Shockingly. I think that she appeals to different voters than Biden does. And I think that she'll help the ticket. I think that time will tell about how people feel about Biden in November, and there's still so much that can happen. I think a lot of people are very frustrated with the Middle Eastern war, and yeah. You know, we'll see where we're at with that in October, November.
I also think that, you know, I think we would be far better off if Kamala Harris was president and if Donald Trump was president. I mean, we've already seen what he does and what he doesn't do. And I think he has only gotten worse over the last few years. I think his rhetoric has gotten much worse. And his policies, those we know, like the tax policies, we know aren't good for the average working family. And we don't know about a lot of his other policies. I think it's not just who's elected president, but who they bring with them. And the turnover in his administration was constant. So ultimately, I think the American people will choose what's best for them and their family. And I don't think it will be him.
A question for Heather from John. So are corporations happy with the direction that Texas and Florida are going?
Well, they're moving jobs there. So I would say probably yes. I mean, I think JPMorgan Chase now has, which, you know, headquartered in New York, started in New York. New York is the financial services capital of the world. They have more employees in Texas than they do in New York right now. So I think you know, I think they're frustrated with the Republican policies that are trying to interfere with corporate governance issues like around ESG and, you know, and social policies. But generally speaking, the economies are very robust in those states. They're growing population, and New York and California are leading the charge in out-migration of people and business.
Chris writes to us and says, by the way, while Republicans have increased voter registration, many have now registered as non-affiliated. I believe it's about a third each, Republican, Democrat, Independent. The opportunity is there for either party.
Exactly right.
Then we go to Nick. We have a couple of letters in this vein, but I'll let Nick do the talking for all of those writers, who says, passing this along, that the Wall Street Journal poll published Wednesday was conducted by Tony Fabrizio, Trump's 2016 pollster and current owner of the largest service provider to Trump's super PAC named Rebuilding America.
Yep.
All right.
And it has a plus or minus of 6, which is, that's not a poll. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. Mitchell says, I'm sorry, Gus says, if you're going to try to predict the issues that will affect the outcome of the election, you should include the very likely increase in the price of eggs because of the bird flu outbreak in the nation's largest egg producer. Doubtless Republicans will seize this and make it Biden's fault. It's sort of always the way, though, Heather, right? I mean, it's some the president is going to take responsibility for whatever ups and downs there are on any given economy or product.
Yes, that is true. I mean, you look at what happened with the bridge collapse, you know, immediately you had people trying to say it's somehow Biden administration policies that caused the bridge collapse, you know, not the giant ship running into the support of the bridge. So that's not a surprise. And I think all the campaigns sort of factor in things like egg prices, gas prices, and then there's things you can't control. You know, you could have if we're importing a lot of something and someone cuts off the supply chain, well, that's going to become the president's fault also. That goes with the job.
But I think the bridge collapse is a perfect example of why it matters to have an administration that's, you know, operating well. President Biden will be in Baltimore tomorrow talking about that. But, you know, the response, that whole of government response to that situation where they understood immediately the both local, regional and national and international implications of what it means to close that shipping channel and to lose that bridge for commerce. You know, I think that that has been a pretty comprehensive response so far. And that's the, you know, showing that government can and does work if you have the right people on the job makes a difference. And I think the Democrats need to talk about that.
Ruth has a lot of ideas on what the Democrats should be talking about. She said, I'd love to see print and video ads and billboards all over the place saying, do you have children over 18 on your health insurance? Democrats brought you that benefit. Would you like to keep your union strong? Vote for Democrats. Is your city improving roads and bridges because of the infrastructure bill, whatever the correct name? Democrats brought that to you. Is your only income from Social Security? Better vote for the Democrats. Do you want to choose your own family planning options? Vote for the Democrats. Do you support the latest immigration bill? Vote for the Democrats. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long list relating to middle-class people's issues. That from Ruth. Doug writes.
Good for you, Ruth. You're
Doug,
right.
Doug writes. President Biden needs to emphasize that Trump's disdain for NATO and the certainty that Trump would hand Ukraine to Russia would mean the destabilization of Europe and increased chances of Trump opening the door to a third world war in Europe, Taiwan, Korea, all of which would have disastrous effects to the economy in addition to all the other dangers of such a war. Then we go to Mitchell. There is absolutely nothing that will convince Trumpians to not support Trump, and the election really doesn't matter as they've had 4 years to perfect their take, to perfect their takeover of the country. Barbara checks in, good morning, with coverage continuing to say daily that the economy is so good you are undermining your credibility. For most Americans who struggle to make the rent and can't afford to live in most cities, we do not believe you. Paying $5 for a box of cereal is more important than a daily stock market report. I believe you were the one that uttered those words. Heather, any thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think she's making a good point. I said, you know, despite the fact that the economy is strong, and when I say the economy is strong, I mean GDP. I mean, you know, unemployment is still at a historical lows. Now we still have people not in the workforce, but our productivity is strong. And wages, there's been, you know, really a lot of wage growth at the lower end of the income scale in the last, probably since the pandemic, some of the strong, and the trend had started before that. All of those things being said, people don't vote on those issues. They vote on how much does a gallon of gas cost. Right. And so those are variables that, you know, they're housing costs and inflation are going to be what people are focused on. And that is not going to help Biden in any way.
Let's go to
two. I also think that.
Go ahead, Teresa.
No, go ahead. Two letters. That's
all right. Two letters. Two letters, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come to Teresa on the way back. Vincent writes, Biden is far from the ideal candidate. However, he has a stellar record of accomplishment that too few voters know about. He has an arrogant and ineffective communication team that continues to drop the ball and stay mired in low ratings. Get rid of them now and get people who know how to convey a winning message. That from Vincent. And finally, we go to Julie. I believe that if Donald Trump lost the January 6th insurrection trial, the current polling would change significantly. Question is, will that trial occur before the election? No one seems to be able to answer that question for sure. It seems unlikely that it will, right? I think there was a general chorus of opinion that it's unlikely that that will take place before the election.
I think they're making every
Go ahead, Teresa. They're making every effort to stall
to slow down every trial. And but I do think that the one that would really make a difference, I think, is the classified documents case. And that's the one where there's a real effort to make that not happen. But I think that would make a significant difference to the classified documents case.
Heather?
And it's the most winnable one.
I don't think... if he was convicted today, I don't think it would make any difference, because I think the strategy of the Trump campaign is to basically dismiss as biased any prosecution and to paint it as part of a coordinated effort to prevent him and prevent voters from having the choice to select him. I am, by the way, not saying that I believe that that is correct. I want to clarify that, but it's something that resonates with Trump voters. And when you look at things like the Bragg prosecution that, you know, look to be clearly politically motivated, you do have, you know, the sort of something supporting his argument. Again, I'm not saying I agree with that, but that's what will happen. If he was convicted today, I don't think it would make any difference.
That's the rhetoric, but I don't think we should normalize that. I just, particularly on the classified documents case, I think you cannot normalize this rhetoric against what are clearly serious infractions on his part.
We are late for a break. We'll go to that. When we come back, we'll move on to other topics. Plenty more to discuss with our terrific group. Teresa Bourgeois, Anna Markowitz, and Heather Mulligan on the roundtable panel this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. All of this and more, First News with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. It is the 4th of April, 10 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we welcome you to the program. public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is with us, an advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan. Anna Markowitz joins us, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, all here to discuss the issues of the day. Let's go to just slightly changing the subject, and just something that we touched on yesterday. Teresa was with us yesterday, and we touched on the subject, and I wanted to look at it perhaps a little bit more before we move off of the overtly political front. But the story about violence, the concern of political violence, the violence of the January 6th insurrection, and looking at the fact that the president is saying that he would release rioters. This from MSNBC, I believe. The presumptive GOP presidential nominee is running on a platform of retribution. Among other dark things, it features a vow to free January 6th defendants, or hostages, as he calls them. A new report sheds light on the inmates in Washington who could be released if Donald Trump regains the White House. Overwhelmingly, they're charged with or convicted of violence against law enforcement officers. As of March 23rd, 27 of the 29 January 6th inmates held in D.C. have been charged with assaulting law enforcement officers in the U.S. Capitol or on its grounds. Of those 27, 19 have been convicted. The report says the cases include some of the most disturbing acts of violence at the Capitol and cities, among many others. One person who helped lead the assault on police guarding the Capitol's external security perimeter. Trump's pledge to free those rioters not only condones but celebrates the violence. Unless one thinks that his pledge subverts the law and order mantra he touts, it only reinforces it. That's because the GOP slogan has never been about upholding the law as written, but rather about signaling the maintenance of a certain social order with the increased merger between the quadruply indicted Trump and the Republican Party that order is whatever serves the party leader, regardless of whether it bends, breaks, or even respects the law. Teresa Bourgeois.
So today's the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I think it's important to think about that in the context of the how dangerous it is to foment political violence. I mean, we saw what happened on January 6th. We saw it with our own eyes. Yet people are trying, the Trump team is trying to redefine what happened that day. But we know what happened that day. And as you know, this people might want to look up this group, Just Security. They're a group within the New York University Law School in New York City. But they have tabulated what has happened to those who are incarcerated, particularly those in the D.C. jails. And as you said, Joe, 27 of the 29 inmates that Donald Trump thinks are heroes and should be freed have been charged with assaulting law enforcement officers in the Capitol or on its grounds. And but also, you know, you've had verbal attacks on elected officials. Think about what Senator Romney said about the number of senators who quietly say they don't want to talk against Trump because of fear of the cost of security for their families. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, as you may recall, was a subject of threats and actions against her. Donald Trump goes after judges, prosecutors, court officers, poll workers. And I think about the Fulton County prosecutor, Fannie Willis. You know, there was all the focus on all the things she did wrong. But in that hearing, the one thing that I found astounding was the fact that it has not been safe for her or her daughter to live in her own home for the last 2 years. simply because of her prosecution of the Trump case and the Georgia case. This is very dangerous, and we really, and it's inexcusable. And people say, well, it's all baked in. Well, it shouldn't be baked in because it has consequences, and it's very dangerous. And one more thing. Yesterday we were talking about RFK Jr. and his saying that Trump and Biden are equivalent. But, you know, in his own family story, what does he say about Trump's, you know, his violent rhetoric and his insightful rhetoric? It's just dangerous, and it needs to be focused on.
Anna?
Yeah, I completely agree, and I also think that, you know, this is very simple. He's trying to tell the public that if he loses the election, that they should rise up again and that he has their back. And if he wins, he's saying that, you know, if there's ever a transition of power, you shouldn't be afraid to do this again, what you did on January 6th. He's trying to build this community around him so that he can try to keep power at all costs. So it's terrifying, but I think it's pretty simple.
Heather?
Yeah, I mean, I agree that we're in for a transition like no other, no matter what. I think there are so many variables of things that could happen. I doubt that the outcome is clear. I am also concerned about what happens if, you know, Trump wins by a lot. What is the reaction going to be? I think now, do I think that there'll be a refusal to transition? No, I don't. But I think no matter what, we're going to have November is going to be the longest month this year. And, you know, maybe it followed only by December.
and the following 4 years.
Prepare ourselves.
Right.
Right. Exactly. No matter what. I think we, you know, institutions need to prepare themselves. I think we've had, if you look at any of the data, the faith that Americans have in the traditional institutions has declined dramatically. There's a complete loss of faith in the credibility of the media, and part of that is the media's own fault for basically picking teams and becoming very intolerant of listening to other viewpoints. You know, churches even have lost credibility, educational institutions. So I think we need to think about who's actually even got any credibility. You can put all the messaging out there that you want as a campaign, and if people identify with the other team, they're not going to believe you. So I'm concerned. I think that it's going to be a very rough go no matter what. I'm very hopeful. I know that there are folks in D.C., business organizations, that are having conversations about how should the business community try and help stabilize after the election, regardless of what the outcome is. Is that enough? No, I don't think so. I think it's going to be a scary time. Sorry to be so like doomish.
No, well, go ahead.
I also think that there are people who know better who are remaining silent. And in their silence, they are complicit in this. And I think we need to hear more from them. I think we've begun to hear from, there are a number of people who work for Trump on national defense issues who've been speaking more and more about the global picture and warning about, you know, he should never hold that office again. And today's the anniversary of the creation of NATO, and I know they have deep concerns about NATO. But also we need to hear more from the law enforcement community where, you know, Trump claims to be on the side of law enforcement, but look at, you know, what side is he on January 6th? Those people who were injured and some of them died later, you know, those were law enforcement officials. And I just think that let's dispute policy differences, but this is not a policy difference. This is the fundamentals of our democracy and our safety. And, you know, we saw it in Charlottesville where, you know, there are good people on both sides when people were marching through the city carrying tiki torches and yelling, "Jews will not replace us." And it's gone on and on and on since then, and it started before then, and it needs to be called out. It is just dangerous, and it's not good for our country. And I think you'd said, well, what about on both sides? Well, yes, we saw what happened when Trump was elected. People came out in massive numbers in the streets, right? But they didn't go to the Capitol and bash windows and threaten to kill, you know, Nancy, you know, threaten to kill people, right? And it didn't incite violence. It incited protest, but not violence.
I was struck by what you said. Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, unfortunately, with respect to law enforcement, you know, the starting point before, you know, you start talking about the rioters is that on the very far progressive left, you have, you know, a lot of folks who support defunding the police, and law enforcement people who work in law enforcement are very sensitive to that. And I think you probably have seen a climb in support for the Republican side in the law enforcement community beyond that which it was prior to like 2020 or so. So it's a tough, I mean, that's a tough message to undermine the credibility of the right on law enforcement, because in context, there's some problems that on the left as well, I guess is my point.
But Heather, I take your point, you know, and that's the messaging. But the reality is, in this most recent, you know, beleaguered appropriations fight, budget fight at the federal level, the conservative Republicans were pushing for deep cuts in the FBI and deep cuts in other areas of law enforcement. So on the one hand, they're standing with police, but on the other hand, they were pressing for deep, deep cuts in federal law enforcement funding. Federal funding for law enforcement.
I mean, I'm not saying,
and that's
I'm not
the
saying
reality
that,
of. Right, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think it's really the rank and file local police, as opposed to federal law enforcement, that is where you have the credibility issue on the Democratic side. But you're right. There's not consistency on the right as far as supporting law enforcement either. So I just think people remember things that are catchy, like defund the police, and they don't necessarily pay attention to how people voted on budgetary items.
Anna?
And it's the Democrats that protected those budgets, not the Republicans. Anyway, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you wanted to add, Anna?
Yeah. Sure. I agree with Heather on this one. I do think that there does seem to be a large overlap between the Republican Party and the pro-police. Like the thin blue line flags often are flown with the Trump flags. And so, you know, there might not be 100% overlap on how budgets get funded or, you know, personally, I think it's weird that police officers are often killed by guns, but Republicans are against gun reform, so I think that doesn't necessarily make sense either, but it's how it goes. So, yeah.
All right, let's go to a couple letters. Cheryl says, Trump needs to be in jail. I'm not preparing for a Trump win, and we all need to talk about a Biden win. Talking about any other alternative is giving in to Trump. Well, I think we have to talk about it all, don't we? I think all options must be explored.
President Biden doesn't get reelected unless people vote.
Teresa, you mentioned the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. 56 years ago today.
And it is striking. I'm curious as to what you think we can take from this anniversary and thinking back on that day.
Well, I think, in fact, I listened again to the mountaintop speech, which is the speech he gave the night before he was assassinated in Memphis. And it was rallying the sanitation workers. And one of the things he was talking about is that they needed to, in a nonviolent way, stand up to to defend their rights, but do it in a nonviolent way. And one of he has so many quotable quotes, but one of the things that he used to talk about is that some people are thermometers who take the temperature, but what we need to be is thermostats who change the temperature of society. And he really challenged people to do that, but do it in a peaceful way. And I think that there are a lot of lessons to be learned from what he talked about needing an equitable society where there was a, right now, I think part of the fundamental problem in our country is this extreme and growing gap, a wealth gap, wage gap, and the loss of the middle class. And he talked about just giving people a fair shot, but doing it in a peaceful, nonviolent way. And I think there's a lot to be remembered and learned from that, and what real brave leadership is, and that how we all need to be involved.
Less than a year ago, I went to Memphis, and if folks have not been to the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, which is at the Lorraine Hotel where Martin Luther King was killed, It is one of the most affecting museums I've ever been to. The way they tell the story, the way they walk you through this look at civil rights in our country, and as you work through the building, you eventually end up in the hotel rooms, motel rooms that were occupied by MLK and his group. And are there in the exact place where he was slain. And can even walk across the street and see where the gunman was as well. It's one of the most emotional places I've ever been to. And I think it's really important and something that people should take part if they have an opportunity. It's really something quite special. Civilrightsmuseum.org if you want to find out more information. Civilrightsmuseum.org. We'll take a break there, and when we come back, we'll finish up our program with our three panelists, Teresa Bourgeois, Anna Markowitz, and Heather Mulligan. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Again, keep your letters short and to the point. We'll get to as many as we possibly can, and we'll move on to other topics as we fill out the last segment of our program this morning. panel@wamc.org. We will continue after this news from the BBC. Very cool thing going on. The program that will take place from 3 to 4 on Monday, live anchored coverage of Monday's total solar eclipse from the Adirondack Sky Center and Observatory in Tupper Lake. The site will fall in the line of totality around 3:28, which is during WAMC's live broadcast from 3 to 4. Totality is scheduled to last for over 3 minutes. Sarah LaDuke, Ian Pickus will interview experts and set the scene at one of the region's most popular spots to catch the eclipse. You can find out more by going to WAMC.org, WAMC.org, and catch the program live on Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Welcome back to the roundtable. Teresa Bourgeois, Anna Markowitz, and Heather Mulligan with us, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC www.thedemocrats.org. Let's go to other topics. In Indiana, lawmakers are going to ban cell phones in class. Now, the schools are trying to figure out, oh, how do we do that? So, school officials in Indiana are looking forward to class without cell phones next school year. A new law with heavy bipartisan support requires school districts to adopt policies banning students from having wireless devices during class time. The law applies to cell phones and tablets, laptops, gaming devices. It allows exemptions for educational purposes with the teacher's permission in emergencies or manage health care. Students can also use technology if they have a disability or are part of an individualized education program. Florida passed a similar law last year, and Kentucky, Vermont, Tennessee, and Kansas are considering it. Supporters say the laws reduce distractions in the classroom, cut down on bullying through social media, and encourage more in-person interaction. Many schools in the state and elsewhere already had these bans on their own. Now others will have to adopt them, though the law doesn't spell out how to enforce it. David Bloomfield, a professor of education, leadership, law, and policy at Brooklyn College and the City University of New York Graduate Center, said the law means more work for schools and staff. Cell phones have to be removed from their persons, and they have to be stored somewhere away from that individual. That's going to take time. It's going to take expense, and it's going to take enforcement. Bloomfield said some schools use technology blocking software, but that raises questions about how students can use their phones in emergencies. He also said the law's lack of specific enforcement measures could lead to racial disparities in how the policies or penalties are applied. Indiana Rep. Julie McGuire, a Republican and one of the sponsors of the bill in the legislature, said some teachers don't even have the power to confiscate phones even when they create a distraction. She said the new law will reduce problematic behavior around social media and teach students to replace screen time with more face-to-face communication. Who would like to start off?
I can.
Okay. Anna.
I love this. As a parent of a 9 and almost 12-year-old, phones are the thing that I am most terrified of for my children. And I think that giving teachers the ability to remove distractions from a classroom is hugely important. I have a few friends that are teachers across the state, and often they will take away a phone of a kid, and their parents will come and yell at the teacher the next day and say, you can't do that. You can't take away my kid's phone. And then the teacher feels helpless, and it reduces the productivity of the class. And so I think giving that teacher the ability to go to the parent and say, hey, it's not me, it's a state policy, will be kind of a good policy that can reduce phones in our school. And I think that our kids will learn more from it. So I love it.
Heather?
I've seen classrooms where the teacher has people drop their phones in a bucket or actually a laundry basket when they walk in the door and they pick it up on their way out. But the teacher gets blamed for being the bad guy in that. I don't think it's a bad idea for it. I think it's a good idea for them not to have access to the phones during class time. Does it need a state law? I don't know. I mean, I would think the schools can do it by their own policy, but having a state law does take the ability out of the hands of the parents who might object to it. So, yeah, I don't think it's really that controversial.
Talk to the kids.
I know. Right.
See how controversial it is. Teresa.
Yeah, on this one I wrote to myself, I'd like to hear what the young people have to say about this and hear from listeners, particularly those who are parents. But, I mean, I think in theory it's a great idea. I think in practice it's going to be hard to do. I'm a little confused about the laptops because so many classrooms use computers. So I don't know how you're going to distinguish between the ones that they're allowed to use and the ones that they're not supposed to be using, but, that's at the margins. But I do think by, you know, all of the data and the research that's out there about how these phones and what they're looking at are designed to be addictive and the bullying, the problems with bullying and such, I think having a break from that is probably might end up being a relief for some of the kids. In the beginning, they'll think it's horrible, but it might turn out to be a relief. But I'd really like to hear from our listeners. But all in all, I think this is something that will catch on and expand. And as both Heather and Ann have said, it also takes some of the burden off of the teachers in terms of retribution from parents and kids, because they have the authority to do it.
I am stuck on the enforcement aspect of it as to how that will work it effectively anyway. Even if you put the phones in a laundry basket, you still have to have a student give it to you. And, you know, if they don't, I don't know.
Right.
I think, you know, we all teach college classes. You go in and you tell students no cell phones, and that just isn't the case. And you try really hard to enforce that. And maybe for a class or two, it dissipates, but then it comes roaring back. I'm not against the idea. I just don't know how you do it. And there was the one line in the article about software that would sort of jam the signal. But again, you know, with so many horrible events happening in our schools, is that a way you want to go either?
But to me, that seems one of the biggest concerns I think parents would have, is because there is, you know, the incidents of school shootings and other things that, you know, what if kind of fear of that I need to be in touch with my child. But I think that all in all, I'll leave it to them. Anna, you're the mom. What do you think?
I mean, I don't think that we're going to see zero phones in schools all of a sudden. I think that there'll still be people who choose not to comply. And that's fine. I think that there's going to be a huge reduction, and that for most people, if you tell them, hey, this is a state law that we're complying with, they will follow along. So I think that this will reduce significantly, even if it's not 100% enforced.
Mike writes to us and says, banning technology in classrooms is a terrible idea. As a former middle school science teacher, I encourage my students and colleagues to use their devices. The Massachusetts Science Standards specify that students should learn to use tools effectively. These are tools. Document experiments and research. Take photos, measure, record, collaborate with others, research. I never had a problem with students abusing their tools. Teach them to use them wisely and show respect for their abilities. And that is from Mike. Also got this letter. Go ahead.
In the law, it does say that if the teacher is permitting it for educational purposes, that it is okay. And so I think that if they were doing an experiment that required photo documentation, then allow the students to have their phone for that activity. I think that that's not against this policy. I think it just gives teachers the ability to confiscate phones when they are being abused in the classroom.
This is a letter from a few minutes ago, but Betsy writes, Teresa, thank you for highlighting the facts about law enforcement and the GOP attacks against law enforcement and the GOP Trump undermining of bipartisan border bill. Culture wars dominate people's emotions, but they don't further solutions. Facts matter. And that
thank
is
you.
From Betsy.
Yeah, there's a big gulf between the rhetoric and the reality of what the Republicans, actions are, their words and their actions, particularly on law enforcement. There's a big divide.
How do we improve that?
Talk about it. I mean, it's easy to say defund the police. And I think that that was, those were words that should have never been used, because that's really not what the majority of the Democrats were planning to do anyway. But I think that we need to talk more about the fact that what is Trump's plan if he gets in? One of the things he's talked about is, you know, they want to gut the Department of Education. They want to gut the FBI. I don't know how you do that. They blocked, you know, the, even this bill, the immigration bill, what would it have done? It would have provided more funding for Border Patrol and also more funding for people to handle a lot of the processing tasks for people coming across the border that are now going to Border Patrol so they can't do the jobs that they're meant to do. And these are all, you know, complex details that it doesn't sound as interesting as defund the police. But the reality is that's the difference between the Republicans and Democrats on actual policy. And, we need to talk more about it.
We got this from Greg. Imagine if children were allowed to have a TV set at their desk. Now imagine TV on steroids at the desk. Social media does not belong in the classroom. Jackie says, hope you are all well. Concerning banning cell phones, as someone in classrooms currently in several districts as a substitute teacher. In many districts, schools use Google Classroom, for example, and students routinely use their phones, especially if they've forgotten their school-provided laptops, to get assignments and to literally do the assignment on their phone and then submit it to their teachers. Overall, would less cell phone use be helpful in some ways? Yes. But overall, there are good uses, and it's not practical to ban them outright, which gets back to your point, Anna, of if the teacher says okay, then okay. Otherwise, lock them up.
Yep. I think that if someone forgot their computer and they were doing a classwork that everybody else in the class is sitting and using a laptop and someone else is using a cell phone because they didn't have a laptop, I think that that would be an approved thing.
All right. Let's. We just have about 3 or 4 minutes on left in the program, and I want to get to just a few more letters before we go. Adrian says, you absolutely do not need a state law to dictate school policies regarding technology. This is the same sort of precedent that encourages laws that interfere with other aspects of education, like class and textbook content. Also, technology is constantly changing, and different classes will have different needs. This kind of thinking ultimately takes power away from schools, teachers, and students. Then John says, it only takes a firm hand by the teacher to sort out when a phone is needed in the classroom and when it becomes a nuisance. It is up to the teacher to set the rules, which I think is one of the complaints from the teachers, right? they don't want to be in that position. Bart giving us a nice pat on the back. Your discussion is so general, it's meaningless. Middle school, elementary, which elementary grade level? High school, what subject? Art, science, English. Does the school have a computer room and a computer teacher? How hard is it to have a rack for phones, just like the classrooms have for code racks? That from a parent and a 20-year teacher, and I think that it was maybe obvious that we were trying to generalize, but I understand the letter, I guess. Okay. Cell phones. So what? It has become a problem because teachers have not enforced some rigor in behavior, i.e. cell phone use. It is an overall breakdown in all simple discipline regarding proper conduct, attire, hats in class, etc. Cell phones should be off and secure in the individual's pocket or briefcase, the way it can be availed in emergencies and or documentation of in-school bullying or violence. The students should sign a document about proper use of cell phones and note the penalties for misuse. Parents could co-sign it and know the fines and penalties. We're fining the kids? Okay. For violations, and the confiscation will result in those instances. Stop making laws for what is simple, as Heather indicated. And then we'll end with David. David writes, I teach on the college level, and for years now,
and I've had a rather draconian policy regarding cell phone usage. I have the students sign an agreement that there will be no cell phone use in my class, with one exception, namely an emergency for which they must be on a call, in which case they must notify me at the beginning of a class. In the statement, I mention that if I so much as see a phone, the student will be asked to withdraw from the course. Regarding laptops, students are permitted to take notes on them, but not use them for other purposes. This can be tricky to enforce, but it is doable. Those are some of the thoughts around what we are talking about, and I thank you all for checking in. My thanks also to our wonderful panelists this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Anna Markowitz, and Heather Mulligan. Thank you all. Have a great day. Be safe.